Well, I got the recorder, but I didn't get my Bible. Go ahead and open your Bibles, please, to Psalm 19. Psalm 19, verses 1 and 2, for the text of our lesson this morning. Psalm 19, verses 1 and 2. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utter speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. That's the reading of Psalm 19, verses 1 and 2. In September of 44 B.C., a great comet appeared in the skies above Rome. Actually, it appeared all over the earth as the day went on. But they saw it in Rome. And not long before that, Julius Caesar had been assassinated. And he was born in the month September. And so his followers declared that that meant that his soul had been deified. And he had been made into a god. And so a temple was built to Caesar. And that comet was called Caesar's Comet. And that was used as the pretext for his nephew, who had become his adopted son, a nephew whose name was Octavius, who became known as Augustus Caesar because he actually was adopted by Caesar, and so took that last name, to become the first emperor of Rome. Now, you understand, and I'm sure you were thinking as I was going through that little bit of dry history, that those people were awfully, they just were superstitious. They didn't understand science. If they understood science, they would know that that comet would appear again. Well, actually, that comet only appears about once every 500 years or so. And so they didn't have any record of that comet appearing before. They didn't know anything about that. Now, much later, Edmund Halley observed a comet. And he noted that that comet had appeared about 78 years before that. See, there was a record of that. And that comet comes around about every 78 years. And so he predicted when it would come again. And sure enough, it showed up again at that next time. And so it's called Halley's Comet. Came in 1986, the last time. And those of you who are old enough were here and saw Halley's Comet when he came by in 1986. But none of us will ever see Caesar's comet because it just doesn't appear often enough. And of course, the point is, they thought this was something that was totally supernatural, something for which there's no natural explanation. And it fit right in with the month that Caesar was born. Of course, it fit right in with the political ambitions of Octavius. And so it was declared a miracle. And their superstition led them to declare this to be a miracle. And so they used that for the pretext of elevating Octavius to be the first emperor of Rome. Well, that comet did not prove that Julius Caesar was a god. But the existence and the orderly activity of comets, the very fact that after Edmund Halley had made that successful prediction of when Halley's comet would return, that some other scientists were able to put together mathematical predictions that actually determined all about the orbits of comets around the sun shows that the universe is an orderly universe. And somehow that has to be explained. How did this enormous, orderly universe get to be here? And how did it get to be so orderly in all of its operations? So that, for example, when 1977, I believe, was the year that the Explorer 2 satellite was launched into space by NASA, that they could predict as it was going towards the outer reaches of the solar system, and I believe now it's exited the solar system, but all the way out to Pluto, sending back signals, observing things that have never been observed close up before by humans. How could they predict where that rocket would go where that satellite would go and how it would get there as it went into the outer reaches of space. You think about, and by the way, that was at a time when computers were not like they are now. And to make the orderly, exact prediction of all going around the various planets as they orbited the sun, and the gravitational pull of all these things around them, that still they're able to figure out exactly where, and made all the orbits it was supposed to. And when you saw several years ago some pictures of Jupiter, and then pictures of Uranus, and then on out into the outer reaches of the solar system, I marvel at that each time I saw it, because that shows the orderly operation of the universe. How did anything so enormous as the universe, and of course it's larger than we can even, science don't know how big it is. They've never reached the outer limits of the universe. And yet it operates orderly throughout by the known laws of science that operate every. How did this come about? Well, I believe that what we have is that not the proof that Caesar is a god, but the proof that there is a God and that he's in charge of everything. And I want to argue with you today, and I hope you'll listen to this, from science. Everything that I'll have to say will be from scientific principles, that the existence and predictable operation of the physical universe, comets included, will lead an honest, intelligent observer, inquirer, to believe in the existence of the one and the true and the living God. Now, I'm going to say something right now that's going to make some of you think that, well, you're being unreasonable. But no, we're not going to be unreasonable. I'm appealing to reason today. I'm going to say something concerning this that is a matter of faith. I cannot prove by science in some ways that there is a God. And of course, you can say, well, nobody can prove that there is not a God. But that's true too. Because you see, the scientific method of study is called the empirical method. It involves observation and experimentation. In order for it to be a matter of science, you have to see it happen. Now, see may be done with some kind of a scientific instrument, but you have to see it happen. And then, when you describe, if a scientist describes the experiment he went through, and here's what happened as the result, then somebody at a later time in another part of the earth must be able to put together the same experiment and get the same results. If they can't, this is not a matter of science. It's just, well, it happened to turn out that way one time. We don't know why. He messed up somehow. He didn't describe it exactly right. Observation and experimentation. You have to see it happen. It has to be repeated somewhere else in the world many times by independent scientists, independent observers that can put together the same experiment and have the same results in the same controlled situation. That's what makes science. That's the empirical method. Observation, experimentation. Let me ask you something. Who in this audience saw the beginning of the universe? Who in this audience saw the beginning of life on Earth? Who in this audience saw anything that had to do with what we call the origin of all things? Nobody's seen that. What can you experimentally repeat? Can somebody create a universe? Can somebody create life on Earth? We'll talk more about that later on, but the answer is no. Can that be done in the test tube or by scientific? No, it cannot be done. Actually, the matter of the existence of the true, one and true living God whom we worship is not a matter of science, because it cannot be reduced to experimentation and observation. It's not a matter of the empirical method. It's a matter of faith. Do I mean by that it's not reasonable? Well, let me ask you this question. Here's something for you kids. If you've gotten to the fifth grade or above, you ought to be able to answer this. Who was the first white man to see the Western Hemisphere? Who discovered America, as the way we used to put that? Well, used to everybody would say, Christopher Columbus, 1492, sailed the ocean blue, October 1492. And his ships landed on Hispaniola over in the West Indies. And he thought it was India, so he called the people Indians.
You remember that little tidbit of history? But now, of course, it was Leif Erikson many, many years before that, who came over from Norway or wherever, something, Scandinavia, and landed on the Canadian shore. And so Leif Erikson was the first white. Of course, nothing came of that, so people don't talk about Leif Erikson, they talk about Christopher Columbus. Well, let me ask you this. Can you prove by the scientific method, observation, experimentation, that Christopher Columbus landed in Hispaniola in 1492? No, you cannot. Because it's not a question of science. It's a question of history. You use other methods to determine what happened historically. It's still a matter of reason. History is a reasonable thing, but it doesn't involve observation and experimentation. It's not the empirical method. They do research, but primarily the research is in written documents rather than in the elements of the universe. But it's a matter of history. It's still reasonable. It's just a different method that's used. Faith is not unreasonable. People think of faith as a leap in the dark. Why do you believe so? Well, I just believe it because. Well, why does it feel that way? Well, that's not reasonable. That's superstition. That's not faith. Faith, biblical faith, is based on reason. I cannot subject it to scientific experiment. The reason is God is not physical, material. He's a spirit. In John chapter 4, verse 24, God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. All right, if God is a spirit, what does that say about the nature of God? Well, it says he's, for one thing, he's invisible. In Luke chapter 24, verse 39, Jesus said, this is when he appeared to his disciples by the shore of Galilee and ate fish with them. He said, "Behold my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones as you see that I have." Jesus was not just a spirit because he had a body. He had flesh and bones. A spirit doesn't have a body. A spirit does not have material existence. And in fact, a spirit is invisible. In 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 17, Paul says, "Now to the King, eternal, immortal, invisible, to God who alone is wise, be honor and glory forever and ever." I mean, God is invisible. You can't see God. You'll never be able to see God in this life, in your body. No man can see God and live. So you can't subject God to the empirical method. You can't observe him. You can't test him. But I do believe that we can go to facts of science. And that's what I'm going to appeal to when I tell you why I believe there's one true and living God. We can go to facts of science. Not to somebody's speculations about science, but to actual things that have been established as much as any scientist can establish as laws of science, that the universe always operates this way and there are no known exceptions to this is the way it's always operated, that we can call, as close as we can call anything, laws of science. This is how the universe operates. I'm going to appeal to those. To establish, I believe, beyond reasonable doubt to a reasonable person that there's one true and living God. We can observe the evidence, scientific evidence, of the existence of God. That's what Paul argues in Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 21, when he shows us why there was no excuse for the Gentiles not believing in one true and living God. The Gentiles were pagans. They worshiped many gods. They made idols to those gods. And Paul said, even though they didn't have the Old Testament revelation, they had no excuse for that superstition. They had no excuse for that ignorance. Because the world around us shows the existence of the one true and living God by its very orderly operation and its very existence. Romans 1, read with me, Romans 1, 18 through 21. "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them." Anything that they could know, that we should be able to know about the existence of God, the nature of God, They should have seen it. It was manifest, made known unto them, for God has shown it to them. How did God show it to them? He didn't give them the Old Testament as he gave the Jews. They didn't have a special revelation from God as the Jews had. How could they know that there's one true and living God? Verse 20. For since the creation of the world, all right, there's the absolute beginning of all things material. Since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, I'm going to come back to this at the end of the lesson. His invisible attributes are clearly seen. I can see the invisible God clearly. How? Being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they're without excuse. I'm going to come back to that verse later and talk more about it in some detail. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. They had no excuse for not believing in God. For the very existence of the universe and its orderly operation should have shown them there's one true and living God. He's the only logical explanation. He's the only explanation that makes any sense for the existence and orderly operation of the universe. We can't see him. It's a matter of faith, but we have evidence for him. And that's what makes it a matter of faith. Hebrews 11, verses 1 through 3. Faith is not a blind leap into the dark. Faith is not, well, I just feel that way. Faith is not, well, my mother and daddy told me that. Faith is taking evidence and acting mentally and then acting in our acts upon that evidence. Hebrews 11, verses 1 through 3. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Faith is the substance. It stands under our hope and supports it. And it's evidence. The New American Standard renders that it is the conviction of things not seen. And that's right, too. It's conviction based on evidence. I have a conviction about God because I have evidence for what I believe about God. For by it the elders obtained a good report. But without faith it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Faith is conviction based on evidence. It's not a blind leap in the dark. It's not just, well, I feel this way. It's not superstition. Superstition is where you think something is true, though you have no evidence whatsoever for it being true. That's a matter of Caesar being God. That's superstition. But the existence of one true and living God is faith. It's reasonable faith. It's based on evidence. And any honest, intelligent inquirer ought to come to the conclusion there's one true and living God. What scientific evidence do we have for the existence of God? I want to begin with the law of causality. This is the basis for science. There must be an adequate cause for every effect. Things don't just happen with nothing behind them in science, in the natural realm. In any realm, there's something that caused that to happen. And the job of the scientist, as an experimental scientist, is to look for, all right, here's something that happened. What's the cause behind this? Here's an effect. What led to that effect? What's the cause for that effect? That's what a scientist does in his observation and experimentation. There must be adequate cause for every effect. Let me ask you, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Well, I believe I know. I believe the chicken came first because God created. But if you don't believe in God, that's a good question. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Yeah, you keep pushing things back till finally, listen carefully, till finally you have to come to an uncaused first cause. You can only push it back so far. And I want to tell you, atheists can never arrive at the uncaused first cause. Anything they arrive at is self-contradictory. Atheism is unreasonable. I cannot be superstitious enough to become an atheist. It would take complete irrationality for anybody to look honestly. Now, that I just contradicted myself when I said honestly. For anybody to look at the evidence and come to the conclusion that there is no God. that there's not one true and living God who created the heaven and the earth. You've got to come up with an adequate cause for the effect. The only cause that atheists have for all the effect is energy. Blind, mindless energy. You know, of course, that many years ago, well, quite a few years ago, scientists started creating these super colliders, atom smashers. And though I asked me to explain all this, and sending these atomic particles together to bust up atoms. And of course, it was nothing to get from them protons, neutrons, electrons, because we've known, even when I was in school, that's a long time ago, people knew that the atom was composed of electrons, protons, neutrons. But in these giant atom smashers, they smashed up those things. And then there's all kinds of, not only subatomic particles, but the things of which the electrons, protons, and neutrons are composed. And they've got some funny names for them, and I can't remember all those names. But those things are not even matter. They are pure energy. Now, what does that tell us? Behind matter, the existence of things that you can weigh and so forth, behind that is energy. What's behind energy? The atheist has no answer. Mindless energy is the only answer that an atheist can come up with to tell you how this universe... Did you ever think about how big this universe is? It just boggles. My mind won't compute that much. I can't. All right, you think about it this way. The sun is 93 million miles away from us. And it's the center of our solar system. We revolve around the sun. The moon is out, as far as men have gone, actual people, they've gone out to the moon. That is nothing. That's, what, 250,000 miles. That's nothing. The sun is 93 million miles. Then there's the solar system around the sun. And do you know this solar system, of which we're a part, is one tiny little speck off in a far corner of the Milky Way galaxy. And the Milky Way galaxy is one of uncounted. Scientists don't know how many galaxies there are. Just myriads and myriads and myriads of galaxies. And they haven't reached the end of it yet. Where did that all come from? And how does it all operate in an orderly manner? And all an atheist said, energy. There was a big bang back there. Well, what caused the big bang? And how did it get to be orderly? Where did it all come from? Energy, as the uncaused first cause, it's just plain is stupid. It doesn't make good nonsense. And that's as far back as an atheist can go. There has to be a cause. All right, let's look at the first law of thermodynamics. That's the most basic law of physics, the first law of thermodynamics. This law states, and this is a quote from Dr. Neil Buffalo. This law states that energy can neither be created nor destroyed, but can be changed in form. Anybody here have Rob's has done a whole lot of work in chemistry. He's a chemist. And Rob, I know when you were going to school taking chemistry, I had one little high school chemistry. Oh, I had a basic chemistry course in college, but very, very basic. Nothing that we even hold a candle to Rob. But I bet you balanced equations, didn't you? And whatever you put on one side, you had to account for on the other side. And sometimes there was an error, the loss of heat. And that's how you account for some things. But whatever went on one side, you have to account for on the other side. You know why? That's the first law of thermodynamics. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed. It can only be changed in form. Where did energy come from? It can neither be created nor destroyed. It can only be changed in form. Where did it come from? You've got to have something to cause it. Law of causality. Well, atheists have no answer. There is no answer for that. Well, second law of thermodynamics. Now, this simply states, again, Neil Buffalo quote, energy tends to dissipate itself. You know what that means? You leave something in a closed system and it tends to disorder. Let me ask you something, parents. You leave your kids in the room for a day. What happens to the room? It doesn't get more orderly, does it?
No.
Doesn't work that way. All right, let me ask you something. Some of you have traveled to be here. And as you were traveling to be here in your automobile, in your car, every once in a while you had to stop and let gas out because you kept producing more and more gasoline, didn't it?
No.
Doesn't work that way, does it? Why doesn't it work that way? Because in an orderly system, or in a closed system, excuse me, in a closed system, usable energy is dissipated and things tend to disorder rather than to order. If you have the universe coming into being with no cause except energy, it cannot be infinitely old. If it were, do you know what the temperature would be outside? Inside too. Absolute zero. Yeah. There'd be nothing because it would have been run down. Sometime in the infinite past, it would have run down. It had to start sometime. What started it? Energy had to start from somewhere. What started it? And it cannot be something that has no direction behind it, because you take stuff in a closed system and you leave it alone and it tends to disorder. It tends to use up all the usable energy and things fall apart rather than getting more orderly. In a closed system with no direction, rather than becoming more orderly, things become more disorderly and there's less and less usable energy. That's the second law of thermodynamics and has never been known to fail. It always works. That is by the reason there's no such thing as a perpetual motion machine. It's impossible, because you're going to be generating a little bit of heat there and it's going to dissipate and eventually it's going to run. There's no such thing as a perpetual motion machine. Second law of thermodynamics. The universe is running down. And by the way, the Bible says so. Isaiah said it, and Paul quoted it in Hebrews chapter 1. He's going to fold up as a garment, get old and fold up as a garment. It's running down. And if it's had to run down. What caused this universe to be here and to be infinitely humongous with power that is unimaginable? Do you know that the sun burns up 94 billion tons of its own mass in radiant energy every second? And the sun is one tiny star in a tiny corner of the Milky Way galaxy that could be multiplied millions and millions of times. Can you imagine the power in the universe? Where did all of this power, where did all of this order, where did all of it come from? A Big Bang doesn't explain anything. First of all, it doesn't explain what caused the bang. And secondly, if it's just a Big Bang, no mind behind it, then sometime in the past, it would all run down and we'd all be froze to death before we ever got here. Absolute zero. No movement of the electrons whatsoever. It doesn't make any sense to say there is no true and living God. Since energy cannot be infinitely old, energy cannot be the uncaused first cause, how do you explain the order? How do you explain the fact that those Explorer satellites always able to operate in the same way as they go out, because the law of gravity and all those other laws involved operate anywhere in space that anybody's ever been able to travel or send anything? And then I want to get into life sciences. The first law of biology, life sciences, is biogenesis. Life comes only from prior life in an unbroken chain. Now, some folks used to think, they know better now. Back in the 50s, there was the Crick experiments. And they claim that somebody had created life in the test tube. That is absolute nonsense. And scientists have known that for two generations now. Never such a thing happened. What happened was, got some water that had some stuff in it like they thought existed in a primeval ocean and kept sending electricity into it, and some amino acids were created. And before they could be destroyed by the same process, they brought them out in a cold trap and saved them. Now, life, first of all, it was something that could never happen in nature. And secondly, there was no life created. And now scientists know that life is so complex that to say life just evolved doesn't even make good. They cannot explain how life got here. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever to say that life just happened to be on this earth. Do you know the simplest form of life is the single cell? One little cell. If you look at a little piece of your skin, then you might be able to make out with your naked eye one cell. The simplest form of life. And now scientists know, life scientists, know that that one cell is as complex as New York City. There's no such thing as simple life. There's no such thing as there is the simplest form of life, but have you ever been to New York City? Some of you have been. Is it easy to get around New York City? Find your way, just no problem. Just show up and just go driving all over, no problem, right? Hogwash. No, it's extremely complex, and so is the simplest cell that you can find in your body or any place on the face of the earth. It's so complex that the odds of that ever coming into being by accident boggles the mind. Oh, just give us enough time. There's no amount of time that would make any sense of a single cell. The law of biology, do you know that that's a matter of superstition of people believing that life comes into being without non-life? Back in the Middle Ages, people thought if you threw out slop, then it would just generate maggots. They didn't know that flies laid eggs, and that's where they came from. That was superstition. That's all it was, superstition. And when somebody tells you that life arose from non-life without a cause, an intelligent cause, they're not repeating science. They're repeating superstition. It doesn't make good nonsense. And by the way, I could go, I don't have time, running out of time already. I could go into the various kinds of life, but we don't have time to deal with that today. What kind? There has to be something outside of the natural realm as the cause. A supernatural cause. What kind of supernatural cause? All right, real quickly. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they're without excuse. When I look with my eye and I see the starry canopy of the sky above me at night, that's what David argued in Psalm 19, verse 1. Or when I see the sun climbing through the sky in the daytime, then I see the existence of God with my eye. How do I see? Because I understand with my mind. There must be something behind that. And what must be something behind that? Even the invisible attributes of God, His eternal power and Godhead or Godhood, divine nature. I see that there must be something that's existed eternally. I see that there must be something that has infinite intelligence. And I see that there must be something that has infinite power and has will, a purpose. Now, when I describe, now think about this. What did I just describe? Something that has eternal existence, something that has infinite intelligence, something that has infinite power, and something that has purpose or will. What did I just describe? Put it in three letters. God. I just described God. You cannot be honest and intelligent and look at the universe. Just step out at night and look at the sky above you. You can't do that without concluding there's one true and living God. It's the only rational explanation. Real quickly, I want to tell the story, but I'll do it quickly. Back in 1972, I remember the year, Sandy didn't want me to do it, and she was right. We didn't have any money. We were flat broke as usual. But a salesman came around and sold us the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I fell for it. And she submitted as the wife, and I believe it was $400. That was like $4,000 now. And we, of course, paid for it on time, which probably doubled the price of it. But we bought the Encyclopedia Britannica, 30 volumes. Oh, I was just fascinated by that. I probably used it a half dozen times, but I don't know where they are now. They're gone somewhere. But we bought the 30 volumes, about 1,000 pages in each volume. Every word spelled correctly, all alphabetized right, and the infinite source of knowledge, the Encyclopedia, best encyclopedias in the world. Where did that set of encyclopedias come from? Do you know? Well, I'm going to tell you where they came from. They were printed in Britain. And over there in England, in 1972, there was a big printing press and a big printing company. And the place was heated with gas, natural gas. And one night there was a gas leak. And there was an open flame in that place. And in that place were stored many, many, many sets of type. The letters of the alphabet, A through Z, and the integers 0 through 9. Many of them stored, and lots of ink and lots of paper. And there was a humongous explosion. There was a big bang. And the printing company went everywhere. And paper and ink and type went everywhere. And it fell back to earth. That was all 30 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Each in perfect order, not a single spelling misspelled word, and the best source of knowledge you ever saw in your life. If you believe that, I'm going to sell you a set of Encyclopedia Britannicas. And I might sell you the Brooklyn Bridge while I'm at it. You know that was absolute nonsense, but why do people believe that the universe, composed of 100 some odd elements, in infinite order, in infinite variety, came an infinite size, came about by one giant explosion with mindless energy some time ago? How could anybody come to that conclusion? The heaven declares the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. We're going to stand and sing the song of invitation and encouragement. If somebody needs to make your life right with the Lord, we invite you to do that. While together we stand, while we sing.
Precious forever, a wonderful word, teach me the pathway of glory. Lead me beside the still waters of blood, flowing through valleys of beauty. Precious forever to Him and to me, with ever Savior has spoken, bearing salvation far over. Yes.
that you'll be with all of those that are sick and afflicted, be with the ways and means being used for them, that they might be restored to their health. Father, we ask for forgiveness of those sins that we've